stands for Montreal.
COVID-19. We must all continue to respect public health guidelines and follow self-isolation instructions. Self-isolate if you have symptoms. Self-isolate after testing. Self-isolate if the test is positive. Self-isolate when you return from a trip. And self-isolate when you've been in contact with someone who's tested positive. Self-isolation is important. Please, take it seriously. Learn more at quebec.ca/self-isolating. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing
on.
There is this thing going on.
Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news? I'm brought to you live.
Welcome to the Wednesday edition of Off the Hour, right here on CQUT 90.3 FM. We are 25 days into the month of November. We are broadcasting from unceded Mohawk and Anishinaabe territory. You are tuned in to The Avalanche, a special presentation of CQUT's Community News Department. The Avalanche seeks to cover issues affecting those with disabilities. I'm your host, Zoe. On today's show, we have two episodes of the Disability Visibility Podcast. First up is the most recent episode, titled Disabled Immigrants. Then is an episode on fat liberation. All that right here on CQUT 90.3 FM. You are listening to The Avalanche, where all abilities are welcome. If you would like to get involved, you can call 514-448-4041, extension 6788, or email news at cqut.ca. You can also follow us on Twitter at AvalancheCKUT.
Spread of COVID-19 is at a critical level in your area or a neighboring region. Getting together with family or friends is prohibited, and traveling to other regions is not recommended. More targeted restrictions have been put into place to limit the spread and prevent a lockdown. Learn more at quebec.ca/coronavirus. Continue to wash your hands, keep a 2-meter distance, and wear a mask when physical distancing is impossible. We need to act now. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
Welcome back to The Avalanche on CQUT 90.3 FM. Up now is the most recent episode of the Disability Visibility Podcast, hosted by Alice Wong. This episode is titled Disabled Immigrants.
This is the Disability Visibility Podcast with your host, Alice Wong.
Welcome to the Disability Visibility Podcast. Conversations on disability politics, culture, and media. I'm your host, Alice Wong. every political issue is a disability issue. That as a daughter of immigrants, I know that immigration is an important disability issue. Today, I get a chance to talk with Conchita Hernandez Figueroa about her experiences as a disabled immigrant. Conchita was born in Mexico and grew up in California. She advocates for the rights of Black children and their parents in public schools in the United States and abroad. Conchita is the founder and chair of BETAS, which stands for Mentoring, Engaging, and Teaching All Students, a nonprofit organization that trains educators in Latin America that work with blind, low vision students and other disabilities. She's also the co-founder of the National Coalition of Latinx with Disabilities that seeks to amplify the voices of disabled Latinx in the disability rights movement. Currently, Conchita works as a blind and low vision specialist for the state of Maryland. For more after this episode, check out another short interview I did with Conchita for the podcast on the 30th anniversary of the ADA, which is episode 82A. So much good stuff. Are you ready? Away we go.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
So, Conchita, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, why don't you introduce yourself and just share a little bit about yourself to the audience?
So, I'm Conchita Hernandez. I currently live in D.C. I work for the Department of Education in Maryland around... I'm the state blind and low vision specialist. I grew up in California, born in Mexico, and I'm blind, and I do advocacy work and disability work and kind of a little bit of everything.
And we're talking in June 2020, in the midst of the coronavirus pandemic. And yeah, I just want to ask how you and your family are doing so far.
Yeah, it's definitely an interesting time. So I'm good. I'm working from home. I live, like I said, in DC, and I'm kind of by myself right now. My roommate is in California. So it's a little challenging because I'm definitely an extrovert. And so being home is not my ideal situation. But I'm healthy and stuff. So I'm doing good, and I'm working from home, and I have a job. So I've been good, and kind of connecting with folks in a different way. I'm generally not the best at connecting with people, to tell you the truth. And so I think this has really kind of made me do it, because, you know, it's important to do and to stay connected. So just kind of learning new things and trying out kind of what's going on. So. Yeah.
So, do you mind sharing your family's immigration story?
Something I wanted to kind of mention about was how, like, disability and immigration go hand in hand, and I don't think people really think about it as kind of being similar. I was originally born in Mexico, and I'm part of 5 siblings. My brother is also blind, like myself. And originally, my parents were like, we're going to go to the United States for a couple of months and check it out and see what it's like, and we're going to come back. So we had no intention of staying in the United States. So we came on a visa. And my parents definitely saw how different it was, especially for my brother and I, where we were able to, you know, get any type of services. You know, we were at the time, California had like really good health, not really good actually, but they had insurance for undocumented children. So I was able to take advantage of that, and my brother was as well. we were able to have IEPs, even though they, now that I know better, they were horrible. But I think my parents saw the difference of what being in the United States meant specifically to disability. And so they did so we decided to overstay our visas and we became undocumented. And so I was undocumented from when I got here, which I was about 5 years old, until like right before college. So I was like 18, almost 19.
And for people who don't know what IEPs are, do you mind if you just explain what that is real quick?
Yeah, so an IEP is if you have a disability in school, you have the right to a free appropriate public education. So you have the right to be in school, to whatever it is that you need to be able to flourish in public education. So depending on the disability, it can be a lot of different things, but it's a legal document. And that's something that my parents really didn't understand. And also a lot of parents that don't speak English is not explained very well to them. So my parents were like grateful. They were like, oh, this is so great that they're doing this for us. Almost like a favor. And I'm like, no. Like, it's not a favor that they're being nice to us. It's the law. Like, it's a legal binding document. So it's a really, really important thing that definitely makes this country unique from other countries, that we have access to that in public school. And that could in itself be a whole podcast.
Absolutely. So when did you first realize you were undocumented?
So I feel like it's all kind of blended together. So originally when we came to the United States, my parents didn't tell us the truth because they were scared that we were going to say something as children. So originally when we came and we came on a visitor's visa, they told us we were going to Disneyland. And so I was like, yes, this is like a, you know, 5-year-old's dream. So they had us like dressed up in like Mickey Mouse ears and sweaters and stuff. And so we were ready for Disneyland. And then we got here and it's like, yeah, we're not going to Disneyland. So I think from that point on, it was kind of like, okay, there's some, you know, something's going on. And my family was very honest with us talking about it. Like we all knew it because it was just a part of our life. You know, it impacted every part of like my parents being able to be employed, you know, who you could be friends with. So I think it was something where my parents talked about it openly, with us and had very honest conversations. But it was also, a conversation about don't tell anybody else. So while we talked about it, like, none of my friends knew about it or anybody in school, just because you always have this fear that if something happens or somebody gets upset with you or whatever, then they could use that against you. And it can really completely harm you and your family. So it was definitely like, this is something you know, and this is something you learn kind of how to navigate the world. And then you learn also to keep it a secret.
Keeping that secret and also really being a fear of discovered and, you know, the threat of, you know, deportation must have really shaped everything about how you navigated the world. And how did that kind of shape you as a young person in terms of just doing a lot of kind of emotional labor to really keep yourself and your family intact and safe?
Yeah, I think there's, you know, there's so many different things that involves. And I think one of them is from a very young age, I understood that there was two worlds, that one of them was like the white, able-bodied, educated school world. And then there was a whole other world of other people who had a very different reality, with lived experience and with being the way you navigate the world. The town I grew up in California, it's a very heavily policed town. I think, you know, kind of bringing it back to like things that are happening now, the police was never a sense of safety and a sense of like community and whatever. It was always a sense of like very much panic. And in California, and still to this day, depending on where you live, you can get pulled over by the police for, you know, having a broken headlight. And and be deported. So it's definitely kind of learning how to kind of deal with all of those things. One of the things that also to myself, so I'm very light skinned. I look white. And so I think in that sense, I learned how to navigate all of these worlds kind of differently. And because of that, I was kind of the spokesperson sometimes. Like if there had to be any type of encounter, it's like, oh, okay, you go talk to them. And so I had to learn how to, like, on the inside be like, oh my God, what is going to happen? But then on the outside be like, hi, how can I help you? And kind of learn to navigate that that world that was like white speaking and, you know, able-bodied. Like at the time I wasn't open with my disability. And so it wasn't something that you could notice right away. So it's kind of like learning how to navigate all those things as a child and kind of learning how that impacts you. But also I think it definitely made me have a sense of like understanding injustice and definitely wanting to be a part of that change. I always talk with some friends and we're talking about like, what did we do in high school? Like, what were you involved in? What it is that you were doing? And I was like, you know, in high school, my friends and I were planning walkouts for immigration reform. So that's what I was doing, because I think we all kind of understood how it impacted. So it's there's so many different ways of looking at that.
Yeah, thank you for that. That's a huge responsibility placed on you. And I'm sure that this is very similar to what a lot of, you know, kids of immigrants. I mean, immigrants have to, like, grow up so fast, you know, especially young people who just have to kind of deal with all these situations.
Yeah, and absolutely. And I think as, you know, children of immigrants and immigrants, we take a lot of roles on that that other kids don't. One of them is like translating for your parents. You know, I didn't have good, like I mentioned, good IEP services or what I consider good quality teachers. I have a master's now in being a teacher of blind students, and I'm getting a doctorate in special education, and I'm in the educational world. Like, that's what I do as a job. And so I understand kind of where all the bad holds were. But one of the things was like, I was translating at my IEP meetings for my parents. And that's just not something a child should be doing when you're talking about something such like a legal document that your parents should know about, or, you know, doctor's offices, translating things that your parents need to be doing. Like, it's just not something that a child should be doing.
What was it like for you to apply for a green card? Because, you know, what were the hurdles and also just the challenges? Because I think, as you mentioned earlier, you know, people just assume there's a very smooth path. Like, there's a linear path, right? And it's not really the truth. So, like, what was your, you know, what did it take for you to be able to get your green card?
So growing up, my parents were always kind of looking for the process to help. We had a lawyer we had for like ever who ended up like scamming us and taking all this money, and we got nowhere. And so my parents are divorced, and my dad married. And so I was able to get a green card because I was right at the cutoff age for when my dad got married, that I was able to get a green card. I have other siblings, and that was not the case for them. So most people in this country that are undocumented, are, we call like a mixed status family. So you have some family members that are documented and some that are not. So that's the case with myself. So it was a long, long, long process, where, I was a minor at the time. So, you know, you go through an interview, they ask you all these questions and stuff, but it's just getting there felt like a lifetime. There's millions of people in this country that are undocumented, and I feel like people think like, oh, well, why don't they just become documented? And people want to become documented. Nobody's like, oh my God, I love the undocumented life and this is what I want forever. People do it because there's no other choice. So it's a very, very difficult process to go through.
Yeah, what was life like in terms of your access to services and also opportunities once you got your green card, especially as a disabled person? Like, was there a huge difference?
There was. It was a huge difference because I was able to go to college. So I was right at the point in my senior year of college where I was undocumented, and I was, I couldn't get FAFSA. I couldn't get any, I mean, you can't get any type of support. And so I was my senior year in high school, and my counselors were like, well, you know, you just can't get FAFSA, and you just can't do all these things. So I was like, oh my gosh. So luckily for me, it was just like the universe worked in my favor. Not to say that it doesn't work in other people's favors, because I feel very lucky, but my senior year in high school, I finally got my status adjusted. And so I ended up going to like a really expensive private college because the application for that school was later on, and so I could apply. And so that's how it changed for me. My counselors never told me rehab existed.
And when we're talking about rehab, we're talking about vocational rehabilitation services, which is a state program that's available across the country, correct?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I went all through undergrad not knowing a single thing about disability or that I could get services or anything like that. So once I learned about rehab and services, that changed my life, because then I was able to learn the things that I needed to do to live as a disabled person. Because I always say, like, I was living, like, I was pretending I was able-bodied, but it was very, very difficult. Because I would like pretend that I could do things, but I didn't really know how to do them. And so it was like this, I'm going to pretend to you that I'm able-bodied, but I don't even know how I'm doing it. And so it wasn't a great situation. But having status allowed me to get rehab services and allowed me to get the training I needed. And that's what really changed my life.
In what ways is immigration a disability issue?
Mm-hmm. So one of the ways is that, you know, like my example, there's a lot of people who are here with disabilities through immigration. So like I have a friend who is from Sudan, and he's here due to immigration. He's a refugee, and also, you know, he has a disability. And what people don't realize is there's a lot of countries that don't take people with disabilities. And so in his particular case, his brother was sent to Australia first. And the idea was that the family would stay together, but Australia doesn't take people with disabilities that are refugees. And so he ended up being separated from everybody else because they were like, you can't go. And so he came to the United States and wasn't able to see them. Just disability and immigration are a part of kind of what have woven this country together. And they're a part of why a lot of families are here that couldn't go elsewhere. Disability is just such a part of the human experience, and so is immigration. And so the two kind of always, in my mind, have gone together because it's been a part of my experience.
Yeah, and I feel like one of the most explicit examples of this is, you know, the public charge rule, because, you know, originally, yes, I think, you know, disabled people were able to immigrate to the U.S., but, you know, with the public charge rule, you know, people who are deemed, you know, who may need services, who may need, you know, entitlement programs, can't be excluded now under the public charge rule. And that's, yeah, that's pretty explicit in terms of just excluding disabled people as, you know, prospective immigrants.
Yeah, and the thing about the public charge rule is, it's exactly what you said. You're excluding immigrants with disability from the opportunity of immigrating. Where that's what other countries were doing, and the U.S. was one of the few countries where that wasn't the case, and so now it is. And so, like, under the public charge, there's specific programs that exclude you from adjusting your status, and they're like SSI, Medicare, food stamps, housing. And so at this moment, there are immigrants in the United States who are going hungry because they may be able to adjust at a future time, and they don't want that. And they don't want them receiving food stamps as a reason why they're not able to adjust status. So we're finding a lot of issues right now where immigrant families are making very difficult decisions. And how do you tell a family, no, 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 don't do that? But they're really doing it in the best way that they can. How do you measure what's more important, like to eat today or to possibly years in the future be able to adjust immigration status? And so those are the decisions people are making, and that this administration is forcing people to make. And for people with disabilities, you know, if you have a disability and you can't receive Medicare, you're in a really difficult position. And so families are making that decision for their children and saying, okay, fine, we will get something for you because you have a disability, but we know you're not going to be able to adjust status. So it's a very difficult position to be in.
So speaking of, like, you know, this time period that we're living in, how have you personally dealt with just, you know, the racism and just xenophobia and relentless attack on immigrants, especially undocumented people, you know, in the last few years under this administration, such as the public charge rule? You know, you talk a lot about the intersection of disability. It's intersection of disability and immigration, but, like, how have you really kind of dealt with it? Because it's incredibly painful and hurtful to so many communities.
Yeah, it is. And I think part of it is I had to compartmentalize so much growing up, being like, okay, this is school and this is white people and this is, you know, how you talk, and then this is home. And I think I still do that. And I think in a way it helps. So I think one of the ways that I deal with it is being active and fighting for change. It's kind of being part of movements that are working for change. And sometimes it's, you know, helping to organize something, and sometimes it's like talking to somebody on the phone. Because I think there's so much pressure to be like on the streets marching and doing stuff. But I think right now for me, it looks like different things depending on when it is. You know, being able to kind of do some things that work for change and being able to have like a network of supportive people who you can just talk shit with, who you can be like, oh my God, I can't believe this happened. And you can just like vent and send memes. I think finding joy in all the things, joy is part of how you heal and how you move on and live. Cause then you're just fighting oppressive systems that are never going to work in your favor. So it's, yeah, that's part of it.
And I want to just wrap up our conversation and, you know, ask you, what do you think of how can people support undocumented immigrants? What do you think is most helpful right now?
So I think the most helpful right now is getting informed about what's happening. I feel like there's always pressure to have comprehensive immigration reform. So depending on how elections go, that's either off the table or not. And really I would recommend, if people want to get informed, United We Dream is a really awesome organization, and they are always posting information on how you can sign petitions, how you can support, how you can, you know, help. There's constantly people in deportation proceedings, constantly. And one thing that has helped is getting petitions around it. If somebody is in deportation proceedings and they can build a campaign around them to say, no, 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 the community wants them to stay, it has stopped some of them, not all of them. So being able to be part of that community where you can show up and say, okay, I'm going to sign this petition that's literally going to take me 5 seconds, but it's going to block somebody's deportation, will make a huge difference. So just be informed. And if you want to know more, I would suggest United We Dream as an organization to kind of follow.
Great. Thank you so much. Is there anything else you'd like to share that I just do that you'd like to talk about, or just anything that, any final comments about immigration and disability?
I think it's just, I really do hope that this year is a transformative year in all of our mindsets. You know, I've heard a lot of negative about, like, oh, hell, this is such a difficult year. And it absolutely is. You know, I've had people close to me pass away to COVID and stuff. But I also think that people are beginning to realize what's actually happening. White people, white able-bodied people are finally beginning to be informed and understand what's going on. And so my hope is that this year, with ADA kind of being at the forefront, that we reimagine what that looks like. It's no longer about, you know, do I have the ramp to go into? It still is. We still don't have ramps, and oh my God, it's horrible. But it's not just, do we have a ramp and can I come into your business? But like, how can I flourish? How can I be a leader? How can I live my life fully in the way that is best for me without the pressures of capitalism, and without the pressures of, you know, independence, and without the pressures of, you know, living by myself, and without the pressures of all these things. So like reimagining what it can look like for all different people in the disability community, and people that aren't part of the disability community, how we can reach out and really transform what the next 30 years look like.
I love it. Thank you, Jojita.
Thank you for having me.
This podcast is a production of the Disability Visibility Project and all the community.
Welcome back to The Avalanche on CQUT 90.3 FM. You were just listening to the most recent episode of Alice Wong's Disability Visibility Podcast. Up next is episode 85, titled Fat Liberation. That's up now.
This is the Disability Visibility Podcast with your host, Alice Wong.
Hey, welcome to the Disability Visibility Podcast. Conversations on disability politics, culture, and media. I'm your host, Alice Wong. Today's episode is all about fat liberation with Max Airborne and Caleb Luna. Max is an organizer for Collective Liberation, rooted in fat liberation and disability justice. They co-founded Fat Rose and is an organizer for the No Body is Disposable campaign. Caleb is a performer, scholar, activist. They are PhD candidates in performance studies at UC Berkeley, where their research focuses on historicizing performances of eating and cultural representations of fat embodiment. Max and Caleb will talk about their lived experiences as fat people, the hate, violence, and oppression toward fat people, and what fat politics and liberation is all about. Our you ready? Away we go.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Caleb and Max, thank you so much for being my podcast today.
Yay. Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much. I'm so honored to be here.
Well, I would love for us to start with maybe both of you to introduce yourselves.
Okay. So my name is Max Airborne. I got introduced to fat activism as a teenager. I had been hospitalized for being fat by my family. And when I got out, I got introduced to fat liberation, which was a pretty new thing at the time. And I kind of haven't looked back. I stopped dieting and I learned that it was okay to be fat. And it just really changed my whole life. And, you know, I credit being alive with having learned about fat liberation. And so, you know, pretty much whatever I've done, I've tried to include fat liberation in my work. And so right now I'm working with an organization that I started with my partner called Fat Rose, which is about politicizing fat people and making connections with other social justice movements and trying to bring fat liberation into the agendas of other social justice movements, and also to, well, to just bring us all together in every way, because fat people are everywhere. Fat people cross every social group.
Wonderful. Thank you, Max.
My name's Caleb Luna. I'm a PhD candidate in performance studies at UC Berkeley. I'm an activist. I'm an artist, performance artist, poet, writer, essayist. And yeah, so I have a bit of a scholarly background and an approach to fatness and fat liberation, but also definitely try to pull from activist roots. And I love what Max does. My sort of impression or interpretation of Fat Rose, and feel free to like challenge this or expand on it, Max, is sort of emergence of radical politics, radical left politics with fat politics, and making clear their affinities and their overlaps, which I really love and appreciate, and is like, I try to incorporate a similar framework into my scholarly work, into my artistry, and my activism.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Thank you, Caleb.
Thank you.
I feel like there are a lot of movements who have ultimately a view about collective liberation. What I really want is for to make alliances with those groups so that we all understand that that includes fat, and that, you know, so that fat liberationists understand that our liberation is tied to Black liberation and disability liberation and freedom for all people. I want us all to be looking at each other and forming one giant coalition that includes fat.
I'd love to learn how both of you kind of, you know, describe or define fat liberation, and how does it look, you know, to you? Like, how does that kind of manifest in your own world?
I think similar to what Max is saying, for me, fat liberation is connected to the liberation of all peoples. I worry that part of the barrier for people to understanding fatness as a marginalized group is, well, one, I think that people actually get a lot of access to power and privilege through thinness in ways that are really culturally normalized and valorized and celebrated, even when thin bodies are produced or maintained in really violent ways. For me, like, it's actually central to how histories of race and colonization have materialized on this continent. There's scholarship that goes and looks at the journals of the original colonizers on this country, on this land, who, including Christopher Columbus, there's a book called The Body of the Conquistador by Rebecca Earle, and she does this. And it's very clear that for colonizers, the body size of the indigenous people who were living on this land was a problem. And it was a site of a lot of anxiety for them in order to maintain their like white European idealized bodies, because they were afraid to eat the foods that were indigenous to this land, because those produced indigenous bodies, right? And so there's always been this sort of colonial anxiety about body size, and that coincides with theories and perceptions of race and racialization, particularly with Black and Indigenous people. There's more scholarship recently, a book called Fearing the Black Body by Sabrina Strings talks about the ways that fatness was produced as ugly through its imagined association with Blackness. And that one of the ways that settlers and colonizers justified their colonization and genocide and enslavement of people is through producing their bodies as ugly, as primitive, as inferior. And certainly not all of that process was about fatness, but at least some of it was, right? And so since contact on this land, there has been fat hatred and fat stigma in order to maintain white supremacy and settler ideals. So for me, fat liberation is very integrated into Black liberation. It's also integrated into indigenous sovereignty and material decolonization of this land.
Caleb, it's amazing to start to understand the history of fat hatred. It's so ubiquitous that fat is just assumed and promoted as a horrible, unhealthy thing. It's become all about health. So the origins of it are absent from that understanding. So I guess what I would say about fat liberation, I feel like fat is considered bad from like the moment we're born. We're given this idea that the body has to be a certain way. And, you know, we know scientifically that babies actually need body fat. And yet, you know, there are even parents who are instructed to give their kids low fat diets, which is, you know, a terrible thing to do to a baby. And, you know, so it begins there. We all grow up with some version of this information that we have to maintain this particular thin body or try to achieve this particular thin body in order to have any access to life, really, to life. I grew up being told by my father that if I didn't lose weight, nobody would ever hire me. And that ended up being kind of true. It's very difficult to get a job if you're fat. And so to me, fat liberation is about kind of coming to understand both the personal, internal experience of fat that we learn and apply to ourselves, this sort of surveillance of the body by the culture that we internalize. And then we're always watching ourselves to make sure that we're not eating too much, or that if we are, nobody sees us. And then it's also about looking at what the culture is doing and how the culture and the systems of the culture are impacting us. You know, so the discrimination that we experience in life and the access issues that we experience in life, you know, the fact that chairs are not made for bodies that are larger than a certain size. And, you know, then there's, you know, even larger things like fat people get denied medical care every single day. Doctors won't touch fat patients a lot of times, or they'll refuse to do surgery on them because they're afraid. They're afraid of liability. So a lot of fat people end up not seeking medical care, or seeking medical care and not getting it. You know, I have a friend recently who had some polyps in her uterus, some fibroids, and they wouldn't do the surgery needed to remove them. They turned into cancer. By the time she realized she had cancer, it was stage four, and she died. You know, that is a direct result of fat hatred. And so, you know, fat liberation seeks to sort of attack all of these fronts, the personal and the cultural and the systemic.
Yeah, I mean, our culture that we're living in has such narrow ideas to what is considered adorable or beautiful or healthy. And, you know, this results in incredible trauma, violence, and abuse to all kinds of bodies, but especially fat people. So, you know, in addition to the things that you just mentioned, I'm kind of curious about what are the other kind of very visceral examples of fat hatred that you've seen or experienced?
What feels very present for me is trying to participate in specifically like queer of color community, right? Which is a community of people that are organized around shared identity in terms of race and sexuality, that also in organizing around race has a fairly clear anti-racist politic, right? And is like pretty attendant to the ways that white supremacy and anti-blackness show up in community. I don't think that we're always like successful at resisting and not perpetuating those things, but I feel like it's on the radar in ways that I feel like conversations around size and ability are not, that feel really frustrating. You know, most of my friends in this community, like, most of them are thin. Most of them don't actually date fat people or befriend fat people. And that feels like somewhat low stakes, but also like leads to lots of isolation and lots of loneliness. And I've written like pretty extensively about the experience of being in these communities and not feeling like I have the same level of care extended to me in terms of dating opportunities. So I feel like that would be my first answer.
Yeah, just I think hatred is, it sounds overt, but I think so many times, as Max mentioned about like the fact that there aren't chairs or benches that, you know, fit Max, these are very often very subtle and insidious ways that, you know, environments and systems and individuals, you know, perpetuate hatred.
There are a couple cases where that I've been thinking about recently where fat hatred, because it's so not questioned, has been used to kind of smokescreen other oppression. Right. So what I'm thinking of is like the case of Eric Garner, you know, fat black man killed by police who then tried to blame his death on obesity. And Kayla Moore, fat black trans woman, also killed by the police, who blamed her death on her being fat. And I recently learned about a case in West Virginia that happened last year, and it just totally slipped my radar because this, I think this kind of thing often slips people's radar because it's pretty ubiquitous and not remarkable to most people. But there was a case of some company that was poisoning a river There was then a lawsuit against them for having poisoned that river. And they basically argued in their case that a level of acceptability of poison needed to be dependent on the particular community. And because West Virginia has a community of people that is fatter than average and fat bodies can handle more poison, they should not be held to the same standard. Right? I mean, I'm laughing, but it's just horrifying. You know, so this is a way that fat gets used as this smokescreen for other issues and a way to kind of get around doing crappy things to poor people and black people.
Thank you for that. So both of you identify as fat people, and I think I'd like to talk a little bit more about, like, you know, the importance of this as both, you know, a personal and political identity, and how being identified as a fat person also led you to community.
I'm a lifelong fat person. I started getting fat in, like, first grade. But it wasn't until I was, like, almost 20, like, my late teens that I, like, really started identifying as fat. And it, at first, was a way, I think, for me to undermine the power of the word when it was used against me. Because it was used against me my entire life as an insult, as a slur. It still is used against me, but I remember, like, one instance where I was working retail and I was a manager, and there was a disgruntled customer. I think she was treating one of the employees really badly, and so I kicked her out of the store. And in response, she called me, like, a fat something. And the employees were also horrified and were, like, checking in on me as if I, like, asking if I was okay. And I was like, no, like, it's fine. I literally know that I'm fat. It's not something that can be used against me, you know? I think that's part of the personal part of it. And then I guess I found fat community in, I would say, 2013. And that was so, so healing and so special. I think in a lot of times in fat spaces, we kind of operate under the assumption that we're all fat. And so therefore we all, like, experience the same thing. This particular community was, like, very clear that, you know, we were different sizes, we were different races, we were different genders. And all of those things informed our fat experience. And so it was a really beautiful context to think about, like, what was my fat experience? And how did it differ from others? I think especially, like, being, like, you know, a non-Black Latinx person who is pretty light-skinned and male assigned at birth, in this kind of moment where, and this is, like, not an unique critique by any means, but many times issues of fatness or fat community are dominated by, like, cis white women, usually straight. And I think that there's, like, a reason for that. But being able to enter into a community that was aware of, like, the different gendered and sized dimensions of the fat experience is really powerful and really important. And so I wish that more of us would be more self-reflective and honest about, we might be fat, but what's actually, like, impacting us directly.
Yeah, you know, Caleb, I feel like a lot of times we get hooked into wanting access to privilege, right? We've grown up fat, you know, we want something. And so people get hooked into narratives around how they can get access to privilege, right? So there's the good fatty, right? Oh, I'm fat, but I'm healthy. I'm fat, but I'm fit. You know, I'm fat, but I whatever. you know, here's the ways that I am good. And so therefore, you know, being fat is okay if you're fat in a way that allows you to have access to privilege, you know. I'm in a lot of fat spaces where that really plays out, where there's like the good fatties or the cool fatties or the young fatties or the small fatties. And, you know, if you're old or if you're super fat or if you're disabled and fat, you don't get access. You're separated off.
Yeah, I love this. Thank you so much. I just had you come about to identify as fat. And how did that kind of give you, kind of led you to finding community?
That's interesting. Like, I'm not sure that identifying as fat did lead me to find community. I feel like I'm not sure I remember not identifying as fat, because I really have been fat, like, since I was a baby. I was always called fat, so that I didn't feel like there was even an option to not identify as fat. I guess I do feel like claiming it in a sort of politicized way did give me access to other people who wanted to do that. So yeah, there was, I guess, some finding of community in that. And I feel like I have certainly been, as a more of an older adult, I have definitely been part of like creating communities that were centered around that. And, you know, joining communities that were centered around that. And that's been both helpful and sometimes tiring. You know, I've had phases of my life where I got a little bit tired of everything being about fat, and I just want to talk about something else for a minute, you know, and then kind of leaving fat community. And I actually had an experience where I really was tired of fat community, and so I left it on purpose, and I went and I became part of another community that was very much about like diversity and inclusion and social justice. And I was like, this community could include fat, you know, like I could maybe be okay here. And I got really involved in that community for 10 years, and ultimately they really couldn't. They really could not get it about fat being okay. And I ended up basically coming back to fat community because of that 10 years.
There is this thing. Do you realize
what is?
There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news? I'm brought to you live.
Welcome back to The Avalanche on CQUT 90.3 FM. You are just listening to episode 85 of the Disability Visibility Podcast, hosted by Alice Wong. For the remainder of this episode, you can check out disabilityvisibilityproject.org. That completes this episode of The Avalanche, a special edition of Off the Hour, airing every Wednesday from 5 to 6. To stay up to date with Avalanche news, check out our Twitter, at AvalancheCQT. Thank yous are due to all those who make educational and inspirational radio here at CQT possible. If you'd like more information on anything you heard tonight, or would like to participate or support news produced by and for the Montreal community, please contact The Avalanche at avalancheCQT.ca or CQT's Community News Department at 514-448-4041, extension 6788, or news at CQT.
Quand vos parents ont besoin d'aide, vous êtes là. Quand vos enfants ont des craintes, vous êtes là. Quand vos amis vivent un moment difficile, vous êtes là. Soyez là pour vous, comme vous l'êtes pour vos proches. C'est possible que la situation actuelle vous fasse ressentir des émotions difficiles ou même de la détresse. Si vous éprouvez de la difficulté à réaliser les actions du quotidien, des solutions existent. Rendez-vous sur québec.ca/allez-mieux ou appelez Info Social 811. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.
CKUT, Henry Grimes. And stay tuned for more of the most aesthetic things, feelings in the world.
If you're young at heart, for it's hard, you will find.
Good evening and welcome to CKUT 90.3 FM and to the December edition of Older Women Live, feminist radio on the air once a month, produced by a small group of old women. Now, tomorrow, the 10th of December, Thursday, is Human Rights Day, the anniversary of the United Nations General Assembly adopting the Declaration of Human Rights in 1948. The theme this year is related to COVID-19 and asks that we build back better. We all want peace, justice, democracy, and human rights. But instead, sadly, the opposite is true. Tonight, we're looking at the case of Guatemala and its struggle against Canadian mining companies. Brisna Kajet-Rowe, one of our Radio Collective members, recently interviewed Jackie McVicker, Canadian researcher, writer, activist, and human rights observer who's lived in Guatemala for the last 15 years.
Hello, everyone. Today we will talk about the activities of some Canadian companies in Guatemala in the context of human rights. On the one hand, Canada's most important economic activity is the extraction